And our special guest this hour, John Perkins, we're going to take phone calls with him. The new confessions of an economic hitman. What an incredible story. Okay, welcome back to Coast, John Perkins with us. And again, his website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com. It's johnperkins.org. And his book is The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's a bestseller, but it's got some new chapters, 15 of them, updating because things have changed. There have been new revelations on this planet, John, haven't there?
Tremendously, George. You know, it's and I'm sad to say this, but things are just getting an awful lot worse. The all the old tools that were used by economic hitmen in my day, fraudulent financial reports, fake reports of all kinds, extortion, lying, even violence, promises, false promises, threats, debt, deception, coups, assassinations, unbridled military power, all of those things have expanded. And they use around the world today, even more than during the era I exposed more than a decade ago. And although this cancer has spread widely and deeply, most people, including here in the United States, especially here in the United States, still aren't aware of it. Yet all of us are impacted by the collapse it's caused. It's just become the dominant system of economics, government, and society today. And we need to change that. And I think the other thing, George, that's gone on is, as I've traveled around the world, I've seen that there really is an awakening. There's a consciousness revolution where people are beginning to understand that this is a failed system and we have to change it. So these two things have happened in the last 10 years where the economic hitmen and jackals have set in more strongly, have spread their tentacles into the United States and Europe. And at the same time, around the world, including the United States, people are waking up to the fact that this system is not working and we have to change it. We have to get out of the death economy and move into a life economy.
What's the motivation, John, for them to do this, those people who are so corruptible? Is it money? Is it power? Is it all of the above? I mean, what do they want? What's their end game?
You know, recently, George, I've been asked to speak at consumer festivals and also at big summits and conferences for CEOs, one for as many as 4,000 CEOs.
Oh, I bet they loved you, right?
Well, you know, it's weird. You know, when I get invited to speak to these things, I call up the organizer and say, why would you want me to speak there? And the answer is, our people, these CEOs, are intelligent. They're smart. They know the system isn't working. And they want to find solutions. They don't know how to get out of this system. They're afraid that if they lose half a percentage of market share by trying to do the right thing, they'll lose their job.
They're gone.
Their
main That's right.
Yeah, they're gone, and they'll be replaced with someone who only cares about market share. And what they tell me is they want me to do is go out and spread the word to your listeners, everybody out there, that we've got to overload them with emails, with Facebook posts, with tweets, telling them that if they want us to continue buying their products, they're going to have to change, and they can take that to their big stockholders and change things.
Back in
the motivation for everyone is the recognition that this system just plain isn't working. This death economy is based on ravaging the very resources upon which it depends, and ultimately, that's totally self-destructive. We're all getting it, and certainly the people who run our big corporations are smart enough to understand that it isn't working, and they just don't know what to do about it, and we've got to show them what to do.
John, back in the early 80s, for a couple of years, I was the executive public relations person and dealt with a lot of corporations in St. Louis and got to know a lot of CEOs. And the big buzz phrase there then, as it probably still is now, was shareholder value. Everything they did in that company was based on shareholder value. So that meant if they had to lay off people, if they had to chop things, whatever they had to do was shareholder value. And I'll never forget that.
Right. And so how do we redefine shareholder value? You know, shareholder value, back when I went to business school in the late 60s, we were told that to enhance shareholder value meant to be a good corporation. It meant to give a decent rate of return to those shareholders, to the investors.
Yeah.
But it also meant taking good care of your employees. A good CEO didn't didn't fire anybody, didn't lay anybody off until he had taken a cut in salary himself. Imagine that.
Yeah, that doesn't happen.
Right. And also, a good CEO would take good care of his customers, his suppliers, and the community where his corporation worked. The corporation would be a good citizen, not only pay taxes, imagine that, but also contribute money to the educational facilities, the recreational facilities, et cetera. That all changed in the 70s when Milton Friedman won the Nobel Prize in economics by saying, no, the only responsibility of business is to maximize profit, regardless of social and environmental costs.
Yep.
Suddenly, shareholder value was defined in terms of maximizing profit. We need to now let these corporations know, that everybody know, that shareholder value means creating a better world, because otherwise there will be no shareholders.
That's right.
The whole shares.
And there may be no world either.
Well, exactly. There won't be a world that we recognize. I don't think we're going to destroy the planet. Even a big atomic blast would probably not destroy this planet that we're on, but it would destroy all life forms that we know of and that we can survive with. We can't let that happen. And so we have to understand that shareholder value now means being a good public servant. It's the old-fashioned way of running business, saying, yeah, the business is here to pay a decent rate of return to investors, because we need investors. We need new technologies to increase this life economy, technologies that will help us develop new transportation, communication, energy systems that no longer rely on digging up resources, that use the sun's energy, that use the air itself, that use all new forms of energy and resources to recycle. We need to pay investors a decent rate of return, but beyond that, the goal needs to be to create a planet that our children and grandchildren will want to inherit. And that's the true meaning of shareholder value. We need to tell ourselves and our corporations a new story about shareholder value.
John, let's take some calls here for you. We'll go to Mike to get things going in Ohio. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Hey, good morning, George, and good morning, Mr. Perkins.
Hi there.
Mr. Perkins, I had a question. If there was an event, say, George is concerned about an EMP or an X flare that would hit maybe most or part of the world, how would that play out financially with IMF, say, with debt forgiveness? And what if it happened to the United States? We owe, I guess, $17 trillion. How would that work out, and what do you think would happen if a natural event happened like that, or a disaster?
An event like what? I didn't quite hear what the event was.
It's an EMP attack, which would be the detonation of a nuke in the atmosphere, which would shut down the power grid.
Right.
We're toast if that happens, first of all. Everything's gone.
Yeah, it would be devastating. There's no question. That's what we need to avoid. And, of course, that's a very scary thing, particularly when we've got North Korea now setting off nuclear weapons, or at least saying it is. Putin himself has addressed this problem, saying, my God, it's inconceivable to think that anybody will do this. And yet there's always that possibility of somebody doing it accidentally, somebody doing it out of fear, or a North Korea doing it simply out of stupidity and vengeance. That would be totally devastating. I can't think of any other way to describe it, how we'd react to it. I think what we need to understand is that we must prevent that from happening. We ought to be a smart enough race where we can move forward and prevent that from happening. Earlier, we heard a reference to Neanderthals and their connection to human beings.
Mm-hmm.
It often strikes me that today we Homo sapiens basically have the emotions of Neanderthals. We're still threatening each other with clubs, although these are mighty big clubs now that threaten to destroy the planet, or at least planet as we know it for human life. We have the emotions of Neanderthals. We basically have a political system that's based on the ancient Greeks. We have an economic and system that's really based on the feudal Europe, the old feudal system, and we have the technology of God. Nuclear weapons are the technology which we could say are God's ability to destroy a tremendous amount of everything. That's a scary scenario.
Sure is.
So we need to move beyond those first three. We need to develop our own consciousness that goes way beyond the Neanderthal. We need to develop our political systems, our economic systems that go beyond the ancient Greek system and the feudal systems. We just must do this. It's imperative that we do, that we raise our consciousness to that point. And honestly, I think we're in the process of making that happen. We just have to, all of us, push a lot harder. And you know what? We have to recognize that there are really two realities. There's the reality of the radio you're listening to, of the chair you're sitting in, or wherever you are. But there's another, that's an objective reality. There's also what I call an imagined reality, which is the reality of all of our principles, basically of our ideas. We're the only living creature, as far as we know, that has the ability to imagine reality. Borders between countries are imagined realities. They've been created by our imagination and then codified into laws. Corporations are imagined reality. Our view of the economy, this death economy, that's an imagined reality that we have to change. We have to understand that these are not stable things that we have to always accept. We must change those imagined realities to create a saner, safer planet for ourselves, our children and grandchildren.
John, I'm convinced that ISIS was a product of government to, one, get Assad out of Syria, but it got out of control. But my question to you is, how in God's name can they generate so much money controlling oil fields, and what banks are they using? I mean, somebody is playing with them.
I think you're totally right, George. And we talked earlier about the declining price of oil and what impact that has. You would think it would be having a huge impact on ISIS. It doesn't exactly seem to be. It's hard to say. There can be no doubt that our policies have certainly created an atmosphere where ISIS has been allowed to grow tremendously. And I suspect that we have a much deeper involvement on some level, as I certainly know that we have had in the drug cartels of Colombia and Mexico. Our CIA, our so-called intelligence agencies, are deeply involved in a lot of nefarious activities. I don't have a lot of inside information on exactly what's going on with ISIS, but, you know, how can an organization like this exist without some sort of support?
And grow so fast. My goodness.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and I think it's important, George, to also recognize that in a way, there's no such thing as global terrorism, because an ism is something that has shared principles. Catholicism, socialism, capitalism, these are true isms. But I've met and talked to members of FARC in Colombia and the Somali pirates and members of Al-Qaeda. They have nothing in common ideologically. There's no common principle.
No.
They're not an ism. They're global acts of terror. But there's no uniting force behind it except the story that we've created. The only thing they have in common is a lot of very desperate people. And so when you get a fanatical leader,
mm-hmm.
somebody with a certain amount of charisma, like an Osama bin Laden, who comes from a lot of money.
Like a Hitler.
Yeah. And they appeal to desperate people who don't know where else to turn, who've lost their way. And so they respond to this desperate leadership. And I think it's really important for us to understand that, and that often that serves the interests of big corporations. Let's face it, the war in the Middle East is making a lot of money for a few people, as the war in Vietnam. You and I may think we lost the war in Vietnam, but a lot of people get very, very rich off that war, and they're getting very, very rich off wars and the threat of wars in the Middle East and elsewhere.
And we lose 50,000 people because of it. At least we did, and then the Vietnamese lost much more. Let's go.
And look at the Middle East today. Yeah, we lose soldiers there, and a tremendous number of civilians are dying every day.
Let's go to Sam in Tempe, Arizona now. Sam, welcome to the show. You're on the air.
Hi. Good evening.
Hi, Sam.
Glad you guys are up as late as I am.
We better be.
So I don't ever sleep very well.
I can't sleep.
It's great to be awake. So with everything going on, and Sarah, I know that you also said that money does cause a lot of corruption. We have a lot of misplacement and displacement of money across the world, not just in America, but as you said, living $2 off of $2 a day in other places. And you look at the grand scheme of what is going on, not just with misplacement of money, but with resources and happiness in government. It almost seems like, and trust me, I don't want the collapse to happen, but it almost seems like a collapse is necessary in order to rebuild, because in order for things to change so suddenly, that almost never happens, even if it's a personal change within oneself. There's usually an awakening and then a breakdown and then a rebuilding. So is this almost necessary to happen? And also, George, on a quick note, when you played that tune earlier from Oregon, my cats were dead asleep and woke up and were scared for 10 minutes.
I know, that's so, a weird sound. Weird sound.
Weird sound. I'd just be interested if anyone else listening, if their animals, if their pets woke up or got startled from that sound, I'd be curious. So thank you very much again. I'll take my answer off here.
Okay. Well, John, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Well, as you look at the economic world in an overview picture, I mean, can we really change it? I mean, with Sam's thoughts on, you know, what's happening, how do we fix it? How do you change things like that? How do we as individuals do this?
Well, George, that's exactly why I wrote The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. The book provides a real strategy for changing this. In fact, it has lists of things that everybody can do. There's a list of something that basically all we all can do, 10 things we all can do. But there's also a list of things that retired people can do, students can do, people between student and retired can do, corporate executives can do, investors can do, shoppers can do. There's these lists of things that we can do. And yes, we can all do that. The long and the short of it is to recognize that the big corporations are calling the shots. You know, they control our elected officials, and sure, it matters who the next president is. Voting is important, but we also have to recognize that the president has very, very limited powers. Big corporations pull the strings, and their lobbyists pull the strings, and yet they are dependent on us to buy their goods and services and to invest in them. And they're run by people, you know. The corporations there are filled with a lot of good people. We need to turn them around.
Yeah.
We need to change them. And I think in answer to Sam's question, yes, it does take something pretty critical to wake us up to the fact that we need to change. And I think that's happened. I think we're aware that the glaciers are melting and the oceans are rising. We're aware that we're in deep trouble, that we're polluting our atmosphere, that our economy isn't working, that less than 5% of the world's population lives in the United States and consumes 30% of the world's resources. That's a serious crisis. That's not a model. China can't do that, no matter how hard.
Well, and people aren't going to take it anymore, John. We're going to come back. We're going to take final calls in a moment with John Perkins on Coast to Coast AM. Well, next hour, Ramon Grace joins me as we talk about dowsing and clearing. It's an amazing story with Ramon. And by the way, John Perkins, our special guest, will take your final calls when we come back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. John Perkins with us, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman. John, are you glad you did what you did? I know you're out of it now, but are you glad you did it when you did?
Well, I think, George, my daughter, who's now 33, once was asked by a reporter that very question, how she feels about what her dad did, and I'd like to answer the way she answered.
All right.
You know, she said, I know my dad has to live with what he did, and he's not always happy with what he did, but she said, I'm really glad that he did it, because now he can talk about it as an insider, and it's really credible. People believe what he had to say because he actually lived it. And so I guess I honor what Jessica, my daughter, said. I'm not proud of what I did. I'm not happy with what I did, but I'm happy with what I'm doing with it now, because I've devoted the rest of my life. I did that for 10 years, and now I've devoted close to 40 years to trying to turn things around. And I'm really getting heated up now with your help to really turn things around. You know, we've really got to move from that death economy an economy based on war, on killing people, and on ravaging resources that I helped to create as an economic hitman. We've got to transfer that now. We've got to transform it into a life economy that's based on cleaning up pollution, you know, paying those companies that we're currently paying our tax dollars to create missiles and armor plate and tanks, to instead create technologies and systems for cleaning up the terribly polluted oceans and air and land, and new technologies for energy and communications and for banking and for so many things that do not depend on ravaging the earth and destroying things, but are really about regenerating and being sustainable. Well, we must do this. And I'm really, really glad to be in a position where people like you are willing to talk to me.
Oh, absolutely.
And people like your listeners are listening to us, wow, and are committing to going out and taking action. So, not proud or happy about what I did, but I am glad that it put me in a position where I can really work hard to change the situation at a time when I think we're going through a huge consciousness revolution throughout the world.
Well, we are. I don't think it's going to be easy, and I still think those one world government folks will still attempt to do what they're trying to do.
They're stuck in an old dream, an old worldview, what I call an old imagined reality, and we need to move them out of that. You know, George, we human beings have faced terrible crises before. You know, it looked like Hitler was going to take over the world to our parents or grandparents. Before that, it looked like the Great Depression was going to destroy everything.
Yeah.
Before that, World War I looked horrendous. Here in the United States, Civil War looked like it would devastate this country. We've gone through huge crises in the past and pulled through. Now we're facing another very, very large crisis, but we must pull through. And as an earlier listener called in, Sam, and talked about, do we need to be pushed by some big crisis? Yes, we are being pushed. This crisis is upon us now. Half the world starving or on the verge of starvation, while a very few people, 62 people, have as many assets as half the world's population. That's absurd. That's a terrible situation. That's worse than anything that we ever read about in Robin Hood. It's a lot worse than the system of feudal Europe. We've got to change it. It's imperative that we do so. And I'm convinced that we're in the process of making that happen. People all over the world are waking up. And so it's a blessed time. It's an exciting time to be alive.
All right, back to the phones. Vincent in Michigan, you're up with us, Vincent. Go ahead.
Good morning, fellas.
Morning.
George,
morning.
There is this author, Andrew Carrington Hitchcock, who authored The Synagogue of Satan.
Yes.
And I believe John F. Kennedy, in his secrecy speech of 27 April 61 at the American Newspaper Publisher Association, was identifying the Synagogue of Satan when he described a most insidious, nefarious cabal that had successfully infiltrated and subverted, subjugated not only the United States government, but, you know, other governments. And he proclaimed that he would, to the extent of his power, eradicate that. Now, Ron Paul comes along and he identifies Federal Reserve as a major problem because they have always failed to maintain a stable economy and a stable currency, which is the essence of their charter. And, George, if you don't know this, I think the most incriminating aspect of the Federal Reserve Act is the fact that the established legally binding quorum was not fulfilled. Only 12 senators present at some...
Really?
Yeah, only 12 senators were present, and because it was, quote, a unanimous vote, their names did not need to be disclosed. So we have, then you have Antonin Scalia showing up dead under mysterious circumstances, and this guy, I'm sure, would have opposed ultimately the continuation of these draconian Federal Reserve, Wall Street gangster, initiatives. And in this book, The Synagogue of Satan, there's a quote by Lord Rothschild in 1790, Amschel Mayor Rothschild says it matters not who writes the laws of any country as long as I own the monetary system. Well, guess what? Ariel Sharon and Shimon Peres, on the 3rd of October 2001, in response to incriminating evidentiary proof that Israel actually conducted 9/11 with the CIA in conjunction, and that was the PNAC group, Richard Perle, Rumsfeld, Cheney, and others. There's some special department in the Pentagon, Office of Special Plans, I think. So anyway, Sharon and Peres on KOL Yisrael made the statement that Americans should just get used to the fact that we own America. And then in 2004, Senator Fritz Hollins of South Carolina and Ralph Nader made distinct statements that AIPAC, American Israeli Public Affairs Committee, which, by the way, in the same year, the FBI concluded their investigation of AIPAC and said, hey, it's a vast spy network all across America, a vast insidious spy network. Well, guess what? The Shabbat Lubavitchers, of which Alan Dershowitz is a member of, there's this other guy, Henry Maykow, an honorable Jewish American scholar, patriot, who authored the books Illuminati 1, 2, and 3. He actually shows a picture of President Obama essentially arm in arm with this guy, Levi Semtov, who is the Washington, D.C. King that controls Congress on behalf of Shabbat Lubavitch.
Well, let's get our reaction here from John Perkins. It sounds like these roots go very deep, John. Have we lost you? John?
Yes.
There you
go. I'm sorry. I pushed the mute button.
Oh, okay. There you go. So were you able to hear some of the caller?
Oh, no. I heard all of it. I was just
okay.
On mute. He wasn't on mute.
Good. I thought you fell off for a moment, but you're back.
No.
But you're back. So,
I mean, the caller just, I didn't get his name, but the caller just, you know, raised a lot of issues.
Vincent from Michigan.
Sure. Yes. I'm not quite sure which where to go with all of that.
That was more of a statement than a question.
Right. And I think, you know, what's interesting about that and what we hear from so many people is a deep distrust of the system and of the information that we're fed. And, you know, I recently saw some fascinating statistics about who trusts their leaders. What countries trust their leaders? The United States is extremely low on that curve. The countries where their leaders are most trusted are the ones that have dictators or semi-dictators, like Singapore, for example. Saudi Arabia actually ranks pretty high. It doesn't mean that the people like what their leaders tell them, but they do believe them. They trust them to move forward. In the United States, we don't. And I think what we're hearing from that listener, as well as from many others, is a very deep distrust of the system. And I think that's healthy in a way, because we should distrust the system. We know that our government lies to us. We know that there have been a lot of conspiracies. I'm not what would you call a conspiracy theorist that believes that there's some doctor know what they're pulling all the strings. But we do know that our government lies to us consistently. Weapons of mass destruction, the invasion of Cuba. There's been so many things that have been lied to us. And it's healthy then for us to mistrust that. But the more important thing is for us to understand that this system is manipulated by the big corporations. And they are dependent on us, and they're run by people like us. We can change them. A story's been sold to us that we don't like, we don't believe, and now it's time for us to change it. And for that listener who just spoke to us, and for all your other listeners out there that are unhappy with this system, that don't trust it, it's time to change it. And you know, the internet makes that relatively easy to organize consumer campaigns, to organize movements, to change all these things. And I think it's time that we did that. And And incidentally, George, and I just want to take this opportunity to say I'm just about to go out on a speaking tour that's going to take me to all over the United States, to various bookstores and other venues. And I would love to meet some of your listeners and have them raise these questions at those forums and personally meet them. And maybe go out and have a cup of coffee or tea or something with them.
Or a glass of wine.
Or a glass of wine or beer and continue this process, because I think we're moving in a direction that's really going to change things. We have this opportunity, and it's been prophesized by indigenous cultures around the world that we are entering a time when it's really propitious to foment change. So I'd love to have some of your listeners join me. Go to johnperkins.org and see where I'm going to be in the next month, leaving on next week. Actually, my first speech.
Well, and you're all over the place, so you're definitely in markets we're in.
Saturday, in two nights, and then I go to Portland, and then I go to Miami, and on and on and on. So I'd love to meet some of your listeners face-to-face.
That'll happen. Let's go to Steve in Columbus, Ohio now. Steven, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you. Thank you both.
Sure thing.
John, I can't offer you absolution, but for what it's worth, you know, those people would have found somebody they sent you to do anyhow. It's wonderful.
Thank you, Steve.
You're talking about it. You're welcome, sir. Please come back to Coast to Coast. George, you're making America so much smarter with your show. Bless you.
Thank you, Steve.
When I talk about this stuff to my friends, I have a few of them that are on this track, but so many people look at me like I had a screw loose. If anything else tonight, you're helping save my mind, because I know it's all true. I told people when I graduated from college in 1979, the average American will never get a retirement, and it is practically coming to pass.
And unless you're breaking up a little bit, Steve, but let me say that, unless you're a regular Coast to Coast listener, if you're one of those daytime people, you just might not get it and understand all these facets that we've been talking about. And you know, John, I've got to tell you, I've been doing this network show now for 13 plus years full time, 15 years in total. And I got to tell you, I've learned a lot doing this program from people and guests like you. I mean, heck, 14 years ago, if you were to tell me that, you know, government's doing this, that, and I'd say you might be nuts. Not anymore.
Yeah. I hear you, George, and I hear your listener, the person who just commented. That's common. You know, the people, I hear this a lot, that people say, you know, others, when I tell them what I know is true, they think I'm crazy. And that's why I write the book. That's why you're on this show, George. And I have to say that as I travel around in the last decade or so, I run into people all the time that come to events that I do or read my book because they heard me on your show. You reach a lot of people, and that's so important that you keep raising these issues. You know, we don't all have to agree on everything at all. We can have some very, very deep discussions, and we can disagree with each other. But the most important thing is for all of us to recognize that this is the time now for us to take control, for us individuals, for we the people, to understand that democracy is based on us taking action and not just looking to government to do it. It does matter who the next president is. You know, it's important for us to all to vote, but it's also important to understand that whoever he or she is has extremely limited powers. We, the people, have the real power. And it's very, very necessary for us to understand that. And I thank you, George, for continuing to spread that word.
Let's take maybe one or two more calls. That'll be it. Greg in Albany, New York. Let's go, Greg.
Hey, how you doing there?
Good.
George and John, how are you? Just going to make a comment and a question. My little part would be, to try to go after the Middle East technology-wise, like to burn water, so we could actually take the control away from OPEC and give each individual country, if they could burn water and do their own solutions of energy, rather than have them dominant by other countries and us and other people, And to your point of having us take control of our nation, all of a complete revolution, maybe segmentedly we could make changes. But when I hear you talking about making changes, drastic changes, other than us having a coup for the taking over the government, I don't see how we could do it so quickly. Maybe year-to-year-to-year changes. But, I'll listen to what you have to say.
All right, got a minute left there, John. If there's going to be change, it's going to come slow.
It isn't that drastic. What we've got to do is convince corporations like General Motors, General Electric, General Dynamics, all the generals to, instead of making military equipment to kill people, let's make equipment to mine those islands of plastic that are floating out in the Pacific, to clean up the terrible oil spills around the world, to clean up the air, water, and soil pollution that is here, to help starving people grow food more efficiently, store it and distribute it, to create new technologies for energy, communications, all of our different things. You know, it is not that big a deal, and we've just got to do it, and we've got to understand that the way that we're going, the economic system we've created, is a failure. It was very successful for many years. It's become too big, too strong, too powerful. We just need to turn it around, and we can do that. We must do it.
I think we can, too. The name of the book, The New Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and if you want to physically meet up with John Perkins, go to his website that we have linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Up next, we're going to do about dowsing and clearing. Have some fun. We'll be back.